This is August 7th, 2016, and today's Teisha will be on leadership. I'll be reading from a New Yorker article from February of this year. The name of the article is Shut Up and Sit Down, and that subtitle is Why the Leadership Industry Rules. And this is by a Joshua Rothman. This is one of the New Yorkers have surveys of different books of one, wrapped around one theme. The theme here being leadership. And I think given the election season, this strikes me as has some very insightful things about leadership generally, not just political leadership, but I'll also take a look at it from a more Buddhistic views. I'm going to, as usual, have to skip some paragraphs to fit everything into 45 minutes. But he will start here with his assertion that for leadership to exist, a leader must cross paths with a crisis. An exemplary person must meet her sinister mate. That's an allusion to the previous paragraph. I should have skipped that. Without an answering crisis, a would-be leader remains just a promising custodian of potential. And then he says, in parentheses, imagine Lincoln without the Civil War, or FDR without the Depression. Before a leader can pull us out of despair, we have to fall into it. For this reason, a melancholy ambivalence can cling to even the most inspiring stories of leadership. I've often read in several places that Bill Clinton was kind of rueful that there was no great crisis in his presidency that would have lifted him into greatness. He continues, people who fetishize leadership sometimes find themselves longing for crisis. They yearn for emergency, dreaming of a doomsday to be narrowly averted. Who could that be? Last month, Donald Trump's campaign released its first official TV advertisement. The ad features a procession of alarming images, the San Bernardino shooting, a crowd at passport control, the flag of Syria's al-Nusra front, designed to communicate the idea of a country under siege. But the ad does more than stoke fear. It also excites, because it suggests that we've arrived at a moment welcoming to the emergence of a strong and electrifying leader. And then in parentheses says, Trump, a voiceover explains, will, quote, quickly cut the head off ISIS and take their oil. By making America's moment of crisis seem as big, and then he says in parentheses, or huge, as possible, Trump makes himself seem more consequential, too. Many of today's challenges are too complex to yield to the exercise of leadership alone. That's a very important point that could be developed quite a bit. Even so, we are inclined to see the problems of the present in terms of crises and leaders. And then he quotes an Elizabeth Sammet, crises of leadership are the order of the day at the beginning of the 21st century. If we live in a world of crisis, she continues, we also live in a world that romanticizes crisis, that finds in it fodder for an addiction to the 24-hour news cycle, multiple information streams, and constant stimulation. That's the end of her words. And then the author here says, Sammet believes that our growing addiction to the narrative of crisis has gone hand in hand with an increasing veneration of leadership, a veneration that leaves us vulnerable to, quote, the false prophets, the smooth operators, the gangsters, and the demagogues who say they can save us. She quotes John Adams, who suggested in a letter to a friend that there was something both undemocratic and unwise in the lionization of leadership. The country won't improve, Adams wrote, until the people begin to consider themselves as the fountain of power. This would square with the primary voting block for Trump, according to all sources, which is white men who've lost their jobs or never had a college education, who, because of these macroeconomic forces of globalization, feel powerless. If they feel powerless, then they're going to look for a powerful leader. They're going to abdicate their inherent power and look to a leader like Trump. He went on, they must be taught to reverence themselves instead of adoring their servants, their generals, admirals, bishops, well, maybe bishops, and and statesmen. And then the author says it can be dangerous to decide that you need to be led. Our faith in the value of leadership is durable. It survives again and again our disappointment with actual leaders. Polls suggest that even though voters who support Trump are frustrated with the people in charge, they aren't disillusioned about leadership in general. They are attracted to Trump's, quote, leadership qualities, and to an authoritarian view of life. In a sense, they're caught in a feedback loop. The glorification of leadership makes existing leaders seem disappointing by comparison, leading to an ever more desperate search for, quote, real leaders to replace them. And then the author talks about how many schools, colleges, and universities are getting into the leadership business, training the leaders of tomorrow, so-called academics study leadership, and on and on. He continues, presidential candidates, of course, invoke the idea of leadership with special urgency. In his victory speech after the Iowa caucuses, Ted Cruz praised Rick Perry, Glenn Beck, and other, quote, leaders who have stood and led. In the 16 presidential debates since August, candidates have used the word leadership more than 100 times. It's an especially useful term for politicians. Experience and expertise are virtues with downsides. Leadership, in quotes, sums up in a vague way everything that's desirable and none of what's not. Let's step in here and talk about a much more sophisticated understanding of governance and leadership and so forth, which is the Buddhist doctrine of dependent co-arising, that no leader is without the led, so to speak, that that these two co-arise. A successful, so-called successful leader, it's not just in her or his inherent qualities of leadership, but in that leader's match with the ones they're leading, in this case in politics, the electorate. A leader, if she or he gets too far ahead in vision or too evolved an understanding, would then lose those who she leads. There has to be, to use just a very concrete example, in teaching Mokugyo players here, I always stress that there is a certain pace that we've settled on, as which is right here, a pace for each chant. It's not going to work if you just if people are slow that day, if they're tired or for whatever reason they're not keeping up with the pace you're setting. You can't just stubbornly insist on maintaining that pace, otherwise there's going to be a disconnect between the Mokugyo and everyone else. There has to be some flexibility. I sometimes use the example of a rubber band. You can stretch it, but you can't stretch it too far, otherwise you lose the contract, the covenant between leader and those who are led. A leader who we could say has failed, a failed leader, may be very evolved, let's use that word, evolved and ahead of his time, but if the followers refuse to go there with him, then it's going to be considered a failure of leadership in a way. Naturally, I've given this a lot of thought in my 30 years as the teacher here, as the director and abbot of the center, and what a sensitive thing this is to what leadership and how complicated it can be. But let's go on. The author cites a 1991 study by a Joseph Rost, who found that the literature on leadership had defined it in more than 200 ways. Often they glided between incompatible definitions within the same book. They argue that leaders should be simultaneously decisive and flexible, or visionary and open-minded. The closest they came to a consensus definition of leadership was the idea that it was good management. More on that later. In practice, Rost wrote, quote, "Leadership is a word that has come to mean all things to all people." He urged his colleagues to get their act together and, a few years later, retired. And then the author reviews more of studies and courses on leadership. And then we pick up here. Leadership may be, by its nature, an anxious and inconstant idea. Like status or alienation, the word leadership points not toward a stable concept, but toward a problem or affliction unique to modernity. And then he cites a 1922 book by Max Weber, who distinguished between the charismatic leadership of traditional societies and the bureaucratic leadership on offer in the industrialized world. The distinction between old-type rulers, who could be moved by personal sympathy and favor, by grace and gratitude, but modern rulers, by contrast, are supposed to be emotionally detached. They work within a network of laws and systems designed to eliminate non-rational considerations like love and hatred. Weber was getting at a core problem for modern leaders. How can the performance of bureaucratic tasks, such as the design of a healthcare overhaul, be infused with charismatic warmth? Conversely, how can you realize your personal ambitions, say, toppling a Middle Eastern autocrat who tried to kill your father, within the systems of bureaucracy? How, in short, can the charismatic and the bureaucratic be combined? Perhaps leadership is confusing because it's confused. It embodies one of the central conundrums of modern life. And then he cites a book by Thomas Carlyle called On Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History, about the... he tried to isolate the character traits of, quote, great men. And then this gave rise to a trait model of leadership. They proposed that leaders possess certain personality traits: courage, decisiveness, intelligence, attractiveness, and so on, that made them intrinsically followable. Bureaucracy be damned. A great deal of time was spent thinking about how leadership qualities might be detected so that leaders could be identified in advance of their elevation. And then sticking now with the trait model, he says it endures. Many leadership gurus talk about Jack Welch and Steve Jobs as people with the right stuff to lead, but plenty of people with the right stuff fail as leaders. This is another source here that found that many companies passed over good internal candidates for CEO in favor of messiah figures with exceptional charisma. This approach vastly overestimates not just the importance of a CEO's personality, but the importance of CEOs in general. And then this guy, his name is Kurana, points out deflatingly that there is little evidence for the CEO effect. The most powerful factor determining a company's performance is the condition of the market in which it operates. See, there it is again. The two co-arising. Leaders are not in a vacuum. They always have to function within the limits and the opportunities of the congregation or the electorate or the larger community that they're to lead. My mind goes to one of the first articles about the Zen Center in a national magazine. This was a now defunct magazine called New Age Journal, and this was about 1974, roughly. And Rick Fields was the name of the author, who spent two or three days with us, and then Roshi Kaplow read the article. When the magazine came out, he read the article and commented on bits and parts of it. And there was one statement that I'll never forget. He read Rick Field saying, "Kaplow doesn't get by on charisma." In other words, he doesn't have much charisma. He had described his baggy pants and plaid shirt. And when Roshi read that, I kind of held my breath, and and he said, I consider this a compliment, to not rest on, not to have to rest on charisma, which can be so dangerous. Aiken Roshi also talks about charisma being a danger, and we see this in demagogues of every kind and false gurus and megalomaniacs, how far they get on charisma. But to continue here, by the mid-20th century, alternatives to the trait model of leadership emerged. Experts have studied leadership psychologically, sociologically, and even existentially, experientially. That's in quotes. Many have settled on a process-based approach. I think this is now we're getting closer to the Zen, the traditional historical Zen model of working your way up over many years of practice to become a teacher. So we talked about the trait model. Now this is the process-based approach. Leadership is something that unfolds in stages. A problem emerges, a leader is selected, a goal is developed, a team is assembled, the goal is reevaluated, and so on. From this perspective, the working life of an organization begins to look like an unending sequence of leadership events. A leader's job, he's talking mostly now about business and industry, a leader's job is to shepherd the team through the leadership process. Process models favor the bureaucratic over the charismatic and have a number of advantages over trait models. For one thing, they suggest the leadership is learnable. You just observe the process. For another, they're capable of differentiating between the designated leader, often a broad-shouldered white guy with a power tie and a corner office, and the actual emergent leaders around whom at particular moments events coalesce. And then he says in parentheses, research shows that workplaces often function because of unrecognized emergent leaders, many of them women. Most fundamentally, process models acknowledge that being a leader isn't an identity, but rather a set of actions. It's not something you are, it's something you do. This is pure Buddhist understanding. It can't be an identity because there's no one there. There's no self, enduring, fixed self that is, remains unchanged over time. We become what we do. The same thing you could say with enlightenment. Rather than speaking of an enlightened person, it's much better to talk about enlightened behavior, enlightened conduct or activity. Because having had an awakening experience doesn't mean you're going to conduct yourself in an enlightened way. We learn eventually that we have to confirm whatever understanding, whatever openings or awakenings we've had, we have to confirm that moment by moment by moment by moment. There's no one there who's had it. We have to be it, live it. But then he says, the process model has disadvantages too. If you buy into the trait model, it's relatively easy to choose a leader. You look for a leaderly personality. If you adhere to the process model, the task is harder. It's easy to see, the process model is harder if you don't have years and years of living and taking more and more responsibilities. He says it's easy to see Donald Trump's chieftain-like traits, his thundering voice, his fiery mane. See, I didn't know I'd get a laugh from that one. All right, but
he's living in there.
but if it weren't for The Apprentice, we would know almost nothing about how he conducts his day job. This poses a dilemma. If a leader's traits are unreliable and her process is inaccessible, how do we decide if she's the right fit? I think it's no accident that the author switches to the female here, she and her, when we consider Hillary's long process. And then he gets into another distinction between Clinton and Trump, is the filtered and the unfiltered type of leadership. This comes from some Harvard Business School professor by the name of Mukunda. He got interested in how different organizations fill leadership positions. He noticed that in some organizations, the candidate pool is heavily filtered. In the military, for example, everyone who aspires to command must jump through the same set of hoops. I would say this is also close to the traditional Zen model. It's filtered. But in Congress, by contrast, you can vault in as a business person or a veteran or the scion of a political family. Mukunda hypothesized that in highly filtered organizations, leaders would end up being relatively interchangeable. In less filtered organizations, individual variation will be greater. By this logic, generals, but not members of Congress, will tend to be more or less equally competent. All generals, he's saying, would be about equally competent, but members of Congress might have gotten there by hook or by crook. I think of Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, who died 30 years ago or so, having once said, it's not that I had anything special in becoming the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, it's just that all the others left. I stuck around. Actually, he probably meant in Japan, becoming sanctioned as a teacher, that the others left and he was the only man left standing. And then he compares these two models of the filtered and the unfiltered from a book called Indispensable, When Leaders Really Matter. This Mukunda applied this distinction to the presidency. He began by giving 40 American presidents a filtration score. Gerald Ford was highly filtered. He had spent 24 years in filtering offices and had been selected as vice president in expectation that he would soon be president. So I would put Hillary in this category. George W. Bush was not. He'd spent 6 years in a, quote, very limited governorship and depended on his family connections. When Mukunda compared those scores with widely accepted rankings of presidential performance, he found that heavily filtered presidents clustered around the middle of the rankings, while unfiltered presidents clustered near both the bottom and the top. Now this brings us right back to this election season. Mukunda's theory suggests that when we select an unfiltered leader, we're taking a big, like say, a businessman, a billionaire, self-declared billionaire businessman. When we select an unfiltered leader, we're taking a big risk. By the same token, there are times when that risk might be worth taking. When things are going badly enough that failure is likely for an average leader, an unfiltered leader, a man or woman who hasn't been watered down, someone who hasn't been vetted and made the same, that's a quotation from Mukunda, may have a better chance of success. Abraham Lincoln, from Mukunda's perspective, was the ultimate unfiltered president, an outsider, during a time of crisis whose decisions differed sharply from the ones his heavily filtered Secretary of State, William Seward, would have made. So you might, you roll the dice with someone who's not filtered, someone who hasn't proven herself or himself through years and years of government service, and you might strike it rich with an Abraham Lincoln, but you also may lose everything. He continues, if Mukunda is right, you should think about the context in which you find yourself when you choose a leader. The question isn't whether a dark horse candidate will make a good leader, who can know, but whether times are bad enough to justify gambling on a dark horse candidate. You can see why it was in the interests of Trump and the Republicans to paint this terribly dystopian picture of the United States, what a horrible, terrible, dangerous place it is, whereas the other party would emphasize the positive. Some version of this idea may drive the behavior of outsider candidates. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders don't spend much time talking about their qualifications. Instead, they tell us energetically that times are very, very bad. He says that after the Second World War, the concept of leadership softened. Leaders, it was said, weren't dictators or tyrants. Instead of ordering us around, they influenced, motivated, and inspired us. A distinction began to emerge between leadership, which was said to be inspirational, and management, which was seen as more punitive. And he says the business books say managers require, leaders inspire. In another, citing another book, he says leaders are narrative devices. It's through thinking about leadership and leaders that we arrive at, quote, an intellectually compelling and emotionally satisfying comprehension of the causes, nature, and consequences of organizational activities. It is the way many prefer to cope and come to grips with the cognitive and moral complexities of reality. It humanizes the forces that shape history. Forces that are often unknowable and indeterminate, perhaps even objectionable. How else could we make sense of a world that has so many interlocking parts? Yeah, so especially yearning for a strong autocratic leader who will save you and make everything perfect is a yearning for greater simplicity. It's an oversimplification of things. Because of the great dangers of charismatic leaders. He says, to some extent, leaders are storytellers. Really, though, they are characters in stories. They play leading roles, but in dramas they can't predict and don't always understand. Because the serialized drama of history is bigger than any one characters are, leaders can't guarantee our ultimate narrative satisfaction. This is what slays me about swallowing whole what any presidential candidate says they'll do for us, as if they're absolute dictators that can make anything happen. We saw under Obama how, when it comes down to it, how many restrictions there are on running, actualizing your agenda, how the opposing party, when they got together and blocked virtually every single thing they could, seemingly just for the sake of blocking his agenda. How limited are the powers of the President of the United States? And that's why I think it is so much more important to look at the character of the candidate. All of these wild promises. Only the most naive person will believe that they can deliver on even half of them. As long as we have these checks and balances, and an increasingly intransigent, oppositional party in the opposition. I think it's so important to look at the character of the candidate. Again, leaders can't guarantee our ultimate narrative satisfaction. Because events, on the whole, are more protean, changeable, than people, leaders grow less satisfying with time. as the stories they're ready to tell diverge from the stories we want to hear. And because our desire for a coherent vision of the world is bottomless, our hunger for leadership is insatiable too. Leaders make the world more sensible, but never sensible enough. I think with my looking at my own style of leadership, which is different than Roshi Kaplow's, who is more autocratic, I think that's fair to say. I think I'm more process-oriented. I love to collaborate with people I trust and get their input before making decisions. But I think what I'm most comfortable with, this doesn't mean it's better or right, but with my own personality is a kind of a sculpting model. I had this explained to me by Todd McGrain, the sculptor who did the memorial to Roshi Kaplow that's in the Founders Garden here at Arnold Park, and who did the other sculpture, Spinning Still, and who is right now working on the sculpture for the courtyard at Chapin Mill. And as a sculptor, he starts to shape something and then sizes it up, looks at it from different angles, sees how it feels, how it settles, and then makes another change and see how that works. And gradually, it's this emergence, this co-arising of creator and the creation. Can you say he's leading it? Is he the leader of that sculpture? No, he's working with it. He's seeing it as it develops and working with it. All right, seems that come to the end here, and we'll stop and recite the four Bodhisattva vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the written way of Buddha. I vow attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the right way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the